Hi, Ryan.
Hello, Rachel.
How are you?
Oh, I am as excited can be. I am beyond words, which is difficult for
Yeah, it
this
doesn't
because
really fit the
no,
format.
discussions often require the words, but
But
perhaps I can speak in smells and
I
feelings.
thought you were going to say tongues.
In tongues, yeah. Well, I'm a good boy. I'm not speaking in tongues today, but we are here to speak about something very important. And no, it's not just why we're called Yum Yum Podcast. Although, Rachel, do you want to give everyone a little bit of a refresher? We have people here who may not know us, may not know who we are, what we're about. So, how about you at least give them the namesake?
The namesake is from Star Trek Discovery in season two, when an individual who is not developed enough to be called a character is. What?
I mean, it's somewhat true. I mean, I know her name is Naan.
Commander Naan D.
Like the bread, Naan. Well, like the species in Babylon 5, Naan, but spelt differently, of course. So you're saying this character, strong character.
Is propositioned by an intergalactic war criminal to go kill the antagonist, and her reply is in the affirmative, but the words that come out of her mouth to express that are yum yum.
It was an amazing moment, an amazing line of dialogue from Star Trek Discovery, a series that is now wrapping up. It's coming to a close, and that's why we're here. We were invited to be a part of this podcasting festival, a look back at the last days of Discovery. And it's a series that inspired us to want to podcast. We're husband and wife team, and we love to watch shows together, and Star Trek is a series that's always been close to my heart. I grew up with it, and we formed quite a close bond when we were first dating because you were watching Star Trek pretty much as a newcomer at the time, right? And it was reruns of TNG and Voyager and stuff like that. And then when Discovery came along, well, I was very much looking forward to it. I mean, Brian Fuller was going to be involved. It was going to be an anthology series. So much stuff was going to happen.
I feel like I was like, maybe it'll be good.
After Into Darkness, anything will be good.
I hadn't even watched it at that point,
Lucky
I
you.
think.
Lucky you. But Star Trek Discovery is wrapping up, and yum yum, that phrase is tied to something that's very important to this series. It's a line in response about killing an antagonist, killing a villain, fighting back against one, making them scream, making them feel the pain. And Star Trek Discovery is about to go for 5 seasons, and each season has quite a range of foes, rivals, bad guys, antagonists, villains outright, that the crew of the Discovery and their friends on the occasion have to fight against or they have to be challenged by. So how about for this, we're going to take a good brief but very long, because look at the episode length, discussion and overview of the catalogue of villains and antagonists that Discovery had. And where did it start, Rachel? Where did we kick off?
Oh, we started with T'Kuvma, one of the many Klingon antagonists for Discovery. And the note that I jotted down for T'Kuvma was such potential.
That is it, isn't it? Because I think we start the show with him giving his rallying cry speech, really setting the stage for what this new Star Trek was going to be, what Star Trek on television during the streaming prestige age was going to be. T'Kuvma, he laid it all out.
He was the draw, and he was setting up a really interesting conflict for the Federation to deal with, but also for the Klingons to be dealing with. And we were sold the fact that this was going to be a gritty show. It wasn't going to be your dad's Star Trek, as people kept on saying.
It's not your grandfather's Star Trek.
No.
No, no, no. And Tugumo really made that obvious.
Yeah.
Like, his aesthetic, the way he spoke, the way the actor carried themselves, and just the viewpoint they were offering up as someone who was opposed.
Down to the way that the camera was positioned around him.
Oh, yeah. Tugumo. So what does he actually do other than just being the first rival that we had to go up against, other than having the potential? What was that potential in aid of? What was he all about?
I'm going to be honest, and I want to unpack that. I don't remember basically anything. I am like, he must have been there with the torchbearer, maybe? Like, I had to look it up because I was just like, all I remembered was Michael kills him. That was it. That was it after all this time.
And the potential. You remember that there was potential.
I'm just like, oh yeah, Michael killed that potential villain that was like, that would have been better than what we got, I think. Like, they might have done it shit as well, but you know.
I do know. I loved Tukuvma. I thought that he was a vibrant character. I remember him.
It was all about bringing the houses together and wanting to make a Klingon empire.
He really wanted to make sure that there was an enemy to be fought, that the Klingon race needed to be revived from the disarray that they had found themselves in. And what I loved about Tukuvma, see, I'm the opposite. I remember him very vividly because he was such a strong impression, and I was so bowled over by this rival that they had to go against. And I was so looking forward to seeing what they would do to unpack him, because it's not only that he was peddling this idea of almost like this like this obvious xenophobia he had against any other species. He was a supremacist, and he had his Remain Klingon. But they went out of their way, and this is something that really dumbfounds me, to give us detailed backstory on him. We got scenes that cut away to him literally as a child. Like, we got all of this amazing material that I couldn't wait to see keep unfurling as we went along, and for us to really grapple with, because in a way they not humanized him, but they gave us more of an understanding of who Tukuvma was than some of the main characters in those first two episodes. And so it's something that I still scratch my head at. I was like, they really set this guy up for the big play just to pull the rug out from underneath, subvert the expectations, and kill the dude and just move on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, in my perspective of Tukuvma, I think he ruined the first season in a lot of ways, because every other antagonist
Felt like a drop.
Yeah, they felt like a bit of a downgrade and a downgrade and a downgrade because of how just supremely defined this was as a person. Like, he had all of this supremacist stuff, and he wanted to make himself a cult-like leader, this like hero among his people. But what we got to know about his past and the way the actor portrayed it, it made me think of David Warner's Cardassian, where once we knew that they were a scared little boy, it's hard to move past that. And that's what this did, where you had the dichotomy of he was this tough guy that everyone's rallying behind. Like, he has a torchbearer. He has all of these Klingons that are just motivated to start a war because of him. Michael Burnham kills him. And yet we also got to see that underneath all of this, he was just a scared little child who didn't know what else to do other than to lash out, other than to beat people up to make himself feel strong and remain Klingon. And now that we're at the end of this all, we're getting to the end of Discovery. What do you think about that move of introducing your big bad and then instantly subverting that expectation that comes with having an ongoing antagonist?
I come at it from a slightly different angle, which is it feels like it is just part of the pattern of Discovery of reinventing itself and throwing away what we often think are the best parts in order to do something else that's more flashy.
I feel similar to you. I think it also is a product of the time.
Yeah.
This idea that to create talk, to make your show a water cooler discussion type series, you just need to fuck with the audience. You need to shake up the expectations. You need to subvert, 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 rather than nurture, nurture, nurture. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel about it, in which at the time I was on the edge of my seat. I found that such a shock, such a brave and bold and distinct move to go with, and to make it that Michael killed him, and in a moment of passion, in a moment of rage, because he killed Georgiou. He killed the prime Georgiou, who we came to know and like in those two episodes as the idealized version of a Starfleet officer. He just kills her. And Michael then turns her phaser on and murders him in a moment of passion. That did at the moment, at like that moment in time, I was compelled. Like, how did you feel about it? Like, if you draw your memory back, was it one of those things where at the time it was successful in what they were going for, but perhaps it's soured now that we look back?
To a degree. Because I feel like even then I was just like, but what are you going to do with this? What are you going to do with this? Because I was nervous that they just were doing it for shock value. I wanted there to be a reason why they were taking away these two well-defined characters that were being very well performed by their respective actors and were adding dimension to the characters and to the plot. I wanted there to be something more behind that.
And it's difficult to swallow the removal of him now, because what that first season had very strongly, I think, in comparison to other seasons, was a very strong like want and desire to push forward themes and messages very much about war and conflict and politics. His remain Klingon stuff and the iconography they used and pairing it up with this cultural fervor and religiosity to it. It was potent. It was saying something. And for the rest of the season, you have other characters, whether they are good or bad or in the middle, circling around these things and sometimes successfully hitting the mark, but it always felt like they were in the shadow of this one particular character who was just so huge. And I am still salty about it, honestly. I think the other Klingons that we get, although have some interesting things and some fun performances, this person, like this character, not even the actor, but that character, he was just too good. Like, it's not the damnedest thing. They made him too good of a character. So when they did take him away, you're still reeling from it by the end of the season. You're like, oh, I wonder what this would have been like.
What could have been?
What could have been? And do you think there is more to it than just pull the rug out for the sake of the drama or not?
No. I don't think so. Maybe the idea was more like this kind of leads us into one of the next people on the list. Was it to set up that like if Dacuvma was still around, it would have been successful, and to set up the underdog aspect of Vok.
That is something that I can agree with, because Takuvma wanted to be a martyr. He wanted to be a symbol. And whether he was actually legitimately successful in the conquest, or if he died, which he did, he would have won. That was what made him really dangerous, is you had to defeat him in a certain way or else it would just fan the flames out. And that was the perfect place to put him. But in a way, how do you defeat him? And if you do, mm-hmm. what do you do from there? And that's where Vok and Laurel mm-hmm. tie into this. Now, Vok and Laurel, they go through quite some journeys. They yeah. don't stay as villains, and they become something else, literally in the case of one of them.
No.
Vok, he was this underdog, an outsider, an outcast. It was an albino Klingon, and he stepped up. He was a believer. He was very much strong in his beliefs of Klingons being the best, being the number one, being the supreme.
Yeah.
And he was going to be the torchbearer, and he was going to be mm-hmm. the new right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Takuvma did die, it was now on this person. And what does that look like? And we often know in stories of dictators or stories of religious figures or high time generals, what happens when they die? Does the person that they relied on, can they actually maintain the empire? Can they maintain the glory, the mm-hmm. vision? And the thing was, Vok couldn't. He sucked. Like, he was too firm in his beliefs, where he would let his people just starve to death on the ship that they were stuck on. And he was just...
Didn't they start eating corpses as
yeah.
well?
Yeah, yeah. And then they were just starving. And he was a loser. Like, the thing yeah. was, you remove the charming, charismatic, very deliberate spokesperson, what does the actual group do? And the thing is, they had no direction. They had no real knowledge of how to proceed forward.
No, they didn't. Would you like to hear my notes for Vok and Laurel, or just one?
Oh, hit us with them both. We're here to talk about them.
So it was, for Vok, such a wimp. And for Laurel, such a mother.
She's a girl boss, please. And a mother. Do you mm-hmm. think they would have changed the language if they made the show a couple of years later? When did Girl Boss start as a big term in pop culture?
Like, the attitude of call me mommy is a thing now, so it's evolved.
Laurel is that, isn't she? Vok, I liked him to begin with.
Yeah.
I like the idea of him.
Like, Australians love an underdog tale, like...
Even if they're villains.
Like, sometimes I'm just like, oh, did that slimy motherfucker get there?
Oh, yeah.
Because he's not far enough in either direction. Like, he's not enough of a sniveling worm, and he isn't enough of a success. So it's just like, you want us to feel sorry for him, but I don't believe that he deserves my pity, and I don't believe that he can succeed. So I'm just bored.
Well, it's also humorous, at least for me. I laugh at Vok because they transform him into Ash Tyler. He sacrifices everything of himself in the goal and desire to eventually win out. And what they do, what they do is they lock Vok away inside of this Ash Tyler. Right. He comes out for a moment and he does some heinous stuff, but then it's... The characters and the show itself are saying, we have moved beyond the supremacy of Vok. We have moved beyond Takuvma's desires. Things have spun out into their own. Oh, and that's what happens when you start a war. You throw a rock into a pond and ripple effects and things get disrupted. And that's how I feel about Vok, where I laugh at, in the end, he did all of this for nothing. All of this to lose, all of this to have his soul taken away and replaced with the very thing he hated, humanity. And yeah, it's very funny. Like, it's very funny because how can you feel for him?
His plan sort of did work, though, but then they do sci-fi nonsense to undo it.
You can't feel sorry for him.
It's just that weird thing of, like, he won, but the good guys played dirty, so he lost.
With Vok and with T'Kuvma, they are unsympathetic villains with interesting qualities because they are fundamentalists, because they're for the eradication of species outside of their own. And that's why...
And then it makes it weirder what they do with Laurel, because she fully believes in that agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And then she holds her home planet at ransom with a bomb.
Because... In her defense, her arc is she does not want to lead.
No, but and she's then forced to.
She not only is forced, but she realizes that she has to. Because look at how much Vok sucks. Like, look how much he's not doing this well. And even when she believes in the plan, believes that his sacrifice is worth it, follows through on it, and then when everything hits the fan...
Mm-hmm.
She notes it down as, this is not the way. And I actually really... Now, talking about it and thinking about this, what I love about Vok and Laurel is they are people who are subservient, and they are people who are followers. They are people who were influenced by a cult of personality.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to those people when the cult of personality starts to tatter? What happens to them when they when they believe it no more? What happens to them? And with Laurel, she kind of mirrors what the crew of the Discovery go through, because they have their own T'Kuvma. Mm-hmm. They have their charismatic leader who's a xenophobic guy who's going to use anyone in his way to get what he wants. And once they find that out, you see they become disillusioned and they realize what they had become was not what they were wanting. And that's what Laurel... As like an antagonist, she goes through a bit where she starts out as this hardcore believer. She starts out as this someone who wants to follow on the orders, but then she actually has to step up and realize what's the point of doing it like this.
Sad thing about that, though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think about that part. I only think about them being like, she's a rapist. Wait, no, she's not.
I had that in my notes too, Rach. It's hard to feel for her because go back and watch the first season. The first season goes out of their way to portray her as a rapist. That's what they do because it was edgy TV.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something where, again, we go back to what we say about the times it was made. It's an obvious statement to say, but... How does that negatively impact the season at large? But what's the point of doing that?
It really feels like a dirty trick that they played on the audience.
Because she's not. The thing is, Ash Tyler has PTSD memories of being Vok, and he doesn't know what that means, and he's misconstruing it. So he thinks of Laurel as not only his torturer, not only his warden, but as someone who sexually assaulted him. And it was a very touching sequence of scenes for Ash
when
Tyler.
When he's going through that with Michael, you really feel for him. And then when they're like, wait, no, that's not it. That's not it.
This is the Manchurian Candidate not working correctly. The memories are merging. Mm-mm. And... what that does in turn is, as much as I would love to like Laurel, as much as fans do and as much as the show itself does, she becomes mother, she becomes the chancellor, the ruler, she gets everything in the end. It doesn't work in the first season where you go back, even if you knew the twist, I knew immediately that Ash Tyler was Vok. You did?
Yeah.
immediately. But it doesn't remove that the show plays it like she's a rapist.
I think we talked about it and I was just like, oh, it's like, because like when we did the pod, we were rewatching. So it was like when we were going through it the first time, we were like, it's too obvious, right? They're not going to do it because it's too obvious. And then the longer it went on, we were like, they're actually, oh no.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Again, even if you knew the twist like we did, I don't see the point of any of it other than as emotional manipulation to trick the characters and us to like Ash Tyler.
Yeah.
And it does no favors to Laurel because even if they say Laurel wasn't bad, Laurel actually didn't do these things, they use the imagery, they use the language, and they have shots of her and musical cues and stuff portraying her as a villainous person because of this heinous act. And sorry, that taste is still in my mouth. That bad taste of that is still in my mouth. Even if she comes in and helps save the day at the end of season two, it's one of those things where season one was jam-packed with so much. Like, look at our list. Half of the list of antagonists were from season one.
Yes!
And I think we need to go on to our next Klingon since we're focusing on the Klingons, because that's what this season was about. It was about the Klingon War.
Yeah, it was Kol. Another one that I was just like, wait, so that must be face paint Klingon, right? That was all I was like. He was the one that like mopped up Vok's mess.
Yeah.
That's all I could think of.
And he hated T'Kuvma.
Yeah.
And he used T'Kuvma's people to just fuel the war, but he didn't believe in the cause.
No.
He was a worm.
Yeah.
Face paint. You mentioned the face paint. We haven't talked about it. The Klingon design in that
the evolution
where it was hard to tell them apart.
So hard. And it was just like, that's why he got known as face plant. But
face plant? He did face plant after Michael kicked him a bunch.
But face paint. But do you want to know what my note for him was?
Of course I do. That's why we're here. Everyone in the chat is saying, no, I hate having notes and thoughts about the villains. Just
have you noticed tell us their pattern yet?
Tell us their memory alpha. No, what's the pattern that you don't remember them very well?
No.
Okay.
No. So my note for this one was such a twerp.
He was such a little bitch of Klingon. He was good though. Like I actually liked Kol as a Klingon bad guy.
He was refreshing within the episodes, especially when we were rewatching for the pod. It was just like, we're gonna get something funny now. Let's see it. Let's see you try and be edgelord. Come on, Discovery.
Well, Kol wasn't trying to be edgelord as much. He was just having campy fun.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, like, the scenes around him. Like, the actor felt like he was showing up and being like, oh, this is camp, right?
Yeah, he was like, I'm playing a Klingon.
Yeah.
This is supposed to be really fun.
That's why
I liked Kol, because he was having fun.
He was
as a
having
character,
fun. Yeah.
As a character and the actor who was played by Kenneth Mitchell, who sadly is no longer with us, but this won't be the first time we see him in Discovery. He would keep appearing again and again. And, I mean, honestly, this isn't my favorite role of his, but I think it was a great one for him to do because it was so rewarding as an actor, even though it was a pretty thankless villain role. Like, most people don't remember Kol.
No.
Most people don't remember him outside of the face paint aesthetic. Mm-hmm. But when we were going through Discovery on our podcast, we made special attention of that performance and of that character because what do you think it is to do as a performer or in the writing to capture that Klingon feel? Because that season was all about cutting to Klingon politics, Klingon culture, Klingon conversations. And yet, Kol in particular was the one that we both leaned forward and said, now that is what I recognize. What do you think it is?
I think it is that juxtaposition of the warrior aesthetic with that sort of almost simplicity of their approach to life and their inability to understand things, or to, like, they always just want to take the most direct approach possible.
When I think back on him as an antagonistic Klingon, there's two things that leap out to me. One, it is about loving violence. Like, he loved doing it. He loved fucking over his fellow.
Delighted in it.
Yeah, he liked killing his own Klingon people. He liked killing humans. Like, it was just
anybody and everything.
It was
kill,
business.
Kill, 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 kill.
And the other, which is what makes him a fun, like, shitty guy, is unlike a lot of Klingons, he wasn't very honorable. He was very much like a Duros, where he was this mealy-mouthed son of a bitch who was saying one thing and acting another.
Yeah.
And he wasn't invested in the war itself. He was invested in himself. He was going to ride off the coattails of what T'Kuvma put down to make himself the ultimate force. That's why he goes back and takes T'Kuvma and his people and his ship and all of that stuff to build up his own build up his own importance off of someone who actually did the legwork. And I fucking love that, because Klingons do that. We see Klingons be self-invested like that. And oftentimes they're secretly working with Romulans or they're TOS Klingons. But I like when you have the Klingon who puts on the face of the
righteousness.
The righteousness, or like Worf or Gowron, or like the typical Klingons we know. And underneath it, they're just a worm. They're just this pathetic thing. And I must admit, when we were going through the antagonists of Discovery, and I was so overwhelmed by season one of it, how many there are and how many Klingon ones there are.
Yeah.
And this is like the last big Klingon one. Who do you think should have been the main, like, antagonistic force? Because I think there's just too many Klingons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it would have changed almost everything about Discovery and the way that the show works. But T'Kuvma.
I see that. I actually think Cole would have been great. If you still killed T'Kuvma and just had Cole do what he does, but more time spent on him.
Yeah.
More time spent on him using the work that T'Kuvma put down to benefit
out, like,
himself.
Like, have T'Kuvma as like a whole season.
Oh, okay.
Like, the stuff that they kind of touch on in those first two episodes, stretch that to be a full season, and then set up Cole. Like, I wanted a couple of seasons of the Klingon War.
I do too. I mean, season one was a mess because of a lot of behind the scenes production issues, a lot of switch up, a lot of change up, a lot of just rookie mistakes. But that's what happens. First seasons are tough.
It is not the worst first season of a Star Trek show.
Oh, God, no, no.
So, like, it's weird that it doesn't have that badge of honor. It has plenty of others, but No, it doesn't take the cake for that. But you know who would steal your cake?
Who?
Harry Mudd.
Does he know it's eternal? Does he know cake's eternal? Oh, yes. I've watched Discovery. I have, and I reference it from time to time. I do. Yum, yum is what I say about cake. Rachel, Harry Mudd, Harcourt Fenton Mudd, shows up here as a, do you remember this? Do you remember the original series? He is one of those rascally little guys.
Hey,
from
he
it.
Does give us probably one of my favorite episodes of Discovery, which is the time loop episode.
It's probably still my favorite episode of the show.
It stands out. It stands out.
It's a throwback to Star Trek we've seen, but it works.
It works.
Oh, man. Harry Mudd. I mean...
And my note for Harry was such fun.
He was fun.
Yeah.
How do you...
Have you picked the pattern yet?
It's a pattern. Rachel's weaving like a tapestry, like the ongoing narratives of Discovery, and it's going to come out into a beautiful quilt that... That Adira would have made, because they're an art genius. Never forget that. I never forget. I remember. They're an art genius. Remember that, people.
That's not the Adira that I think of when you say that name, though.
No, but Harry Mudd.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the things that they advertised before when the show was coming out.
Yeah. I think because they had a well-known actor.
And it's a beloved character.
And it's a beloved character. And the combination of those two, it's just like, ooh, I can see the money now.
Now, I'm more familiar with Harry Mudd. I mean, you've seen the Harry Mudd episodes, mm-hmm. but when Discovery was starting, you didn't have as a long-term knowledge or familiarity with him. So how about you kind of tell us a bit about what you thought of this character as basically... their own thing, because it's hard for me to separate, like, well, this is a modernization of an old
that
character.
Is what I came to accept it as. This was Rainn Wilson's interpretation of Harry Mudd. It wasn't exactly the same character. It has links to it, but it doesn't feel like this is where Harry started and then he ends up where he is in the original series. It feels reversed.
Mm.
It feels like this is what he would have devolved into after TOS. So it feels like it's in a prequel, but he feels like he's in the sequel.
I agree. In a weird way, Harry Mudd is a comedic relief villain. In this and in the original show, you don't take Harry Mudd that seriously.
No, but he is a threat.
He's gross.
Yeah.
And he's a very human threat. Mm-hmm. He's just a con man. He's just a criminal. He's just someone who's a profiteer.
That in space.
Yeah, he's just that in space. Mm-hmm. I loved Rainn Wilson's interpretation because... Mm-hmm.
I particularly enjoyed him in the elevator.
Yeah. I always think of him when, like, we first meet him in the prison cell with his little bug.
Yeah. Because it's just like with Harry Mudd, more than any of the others, I have several moments where I'm like, oh, that was a Harry Mudd thing. That was a Harry Mudd thing. I like that. I like this. And, oh, that was good. And that was fun. And I think back fondly when I think of Harry Mudd in this series.
Oh, of course. And I, for myself, a reason other than he has one of the best episodes of Discovery is, I think a reason why I look back upon him so graciously is he was in a season of people who were taking it deadly serious. Season one
He was a reprieve.
He was a reprieve and he was much needed.
Yes.
The first season was very dour. There wasn't a lot of time for fun. And yet, when he came in, he allowed that. The time loop episode is one of the first times in the show in which we got to see our characters just not in plot mode, not in work mode. They were having downtime. We even got to see one of my favorite moments of Lorca, in which he gets told, like, we're going to do this thing. It's a scientific thing. And he just says, I still don't give a damn. Like, because Lorca doesn't give a shit about the Federation values, but he has to pretend. But even in that moment, he's like, I don't care.
No,
I don't give
whatever.
But Harry Mudd was like this vehicle to allow the levity to come in. And yet he was still very much a Discovery character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't like they took the TOS character and plopped him in Discovery. He felt like he belonged in that world and was of that universe.
He was meaner He was more violent, which I don't know how to feel. Like, Harry Mudd kills people in this show. Like, he brutally kills people.
So many kills. And he gets so many murders.
And he gets off on it, is the difference. Like, Harry Mudd in the original show, he got off on, like, little schemes, but I don't know.
Pretty much everybody seems to get off on murder in Discovery, particularly season one. Like, all of the Klingons are frothing for it. Michael is. Lorca is.
Oh, Lorca loves it. Yeah. Harry Mudd. Rainn Wilson, I wish he would come back in Strange New Worlds at least. I don't know if he ever will.
That would be fun.
I'd love to see him play off of Anson Mount.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. But weirdly, it also feels like after doing the short trek,
he was done.
He's satisfied because he got more ownership over that. He got to do exactly what he wanted with Harry Mudd for that. So then coming back and doing anything would feel...
But I just wish he would.
I'm speculating on the way that Rainn Wilson feels about it, not what I want.
He does the perfect performance because... It's an impersonation without going too far over.
He
clearly is evoking the original performance. Mm-hmm. He has that feel of someone from the 60s, but he's still bringing his own special Rainn Wilson qualities and making it his own. And that's all you can ask.
You get why they cast him.
Because it's fan service. It's fan service to bring Harry. He doesn't need to be in the season at all. He doesn't add much to the plot. He's there as a thing you know. And if it was lesser done in the performance, especially, we probably wouldn't look upon it as favorably as we do. Because again, with a lot of these new actors, whether it's Ethan Peck as Spock or Anson Mount as Pike, they aren't doing one-to-one impressions, but they are bringing those elements of the original performances and doing their own.
Inspired by.
They're inspired by. And he definitely, as Harry Mudd, is the most overwhelmingly on point because he does feel like a 1960s TV show character, but with enough of that grit of Discovery and to make him land more than just as a weird oddity. Like, no one who isn't familiar with the original show raises their eyebrow at Harry Mudd as, like, a thing that shouldn't belong in the show at all.
And he provides an interesting sort of mirror or foil to Lorca as a villain because Harry is so upfront with his nature.
And Harry cannot help but, like, tell everyone his plans and tell everyone what he's doing, while Lorca, that's the opposite.
Yeah.
He needs to be secretive. He needs to keep everything close to the vest because he's got a grand scheme in mind. And that takes us to our beloved first captain of the Discovery, Gabriel Lorca, of course, from the Mirror Universe. It's not Prime Lorca. What's your note?
Such potential.
Really? Such potential? You don't think it paid off?
No, I do. I do. But I was like, I can't say such success because it doesn't fully get there. Like... It's just like, just with a little tweak, it would be success. But I was like, I was searching for an adjective or a synonym to swap in there. And I just kept on being like, potential will do the job because we'll discuss it more.
So Gabriel Lorca, I detested when he first showed up because he was too overtly evil captain.
Yeah.
He literally had no lighting in his rooms. Like, he had, like, zero lighting because his eyes, and he has evil, like, he has fucked up eyes, and he's always eating fortune cookies, and he's saying villainous lines of dialogue with a southern drawl, and it's Jason Isaacs.
Yeah.
Who plays bad guys more than he plays good guys.
Yeah, the casting really tipped it for us.
Yes.
Because we were just
it
like,
for everyone.
Like
it's Malfoy's dad.
Maybe they're countercasting because you know that happens sometimes, and you were watching the OA at the same time, and you were just like, he's doing very similar things.
Yeah, the OA was a little later, but yes, he often plays these types. But here's the thing, I grew to really like Lorca because they did exactly what you said, where it felt like, oh, they did countercasting, where they cast someone who's obviously villainous. They made me think he was obviously the villain because of all of these things. I would lessen those if it was up to me. Like, I don't think the evil lighting helps.
Turn it down a little bit more.
I don't think the evil lighting helps, especially as the seasons go on. They totally, like, sidetrack the eyes of Terran being different. Like the show doesn't care about that after a certain point because it's dumb. It's dumb, but
they wanted a test.
They
wanted to be able to say like, oh, if they're like this, then that means that they're not of our universe.
And it means that we can have an obvious, oh, Lorca is from this universe because of his eyes.
Yeah.
But
it's like I'm not meant to have figured that out until so late.
Of course.
And that's another thing that we've had with Discovery of it assumes that we aren't able to figure things out on our own, and then it'll be like, ha-ha, you didn't realize this, and you're like, wait.
I did, though.
I figured it out several episodes ago, and I thought this other thing was the reveal of this, not this moment.
I thought that Lorca was better played with that stuff.
Yes.
They had a lot of little details that I didn't really notice until rewatches that were more overt about who he was.
Delighted when we registered that he was eating all of this shellfish and fish throughout the whole show. Whole show.
Where did you get it from?
Because he missed eating kelpians.
That's maybe the funniest thing Discovery's ever done.
I fucking love it.
It's one of those things where I genuinely think that's a brilliant touch that they brought into the show that rewards a rewatch.
Yeah.
That's not one of those that they cut to in the explanation of he's a bad guy.
No.
They didn't do a flashback. And that's the thing with Lorca. I think overall, outside of like when they did the big reveal of like, he's this guy, there was subtlety, there was nuances, and there was telltale signs that there was things wrong with him. But in the world of Discovery, is he really that bad in comparison to how we see other characters who are also kind of shitty people? But then that's the thing. He's their leader and he's swaying them to become
infecting. The rest of the crew.
Indoctrinating them into being
morals. Yes.
Being bad.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's a great pitch for a season and a villain of your Star Trek captain, the guy in the chair. He's actually, I don't know how to feel about the Mirrorverse thing. We'll talk about that. But like he has such a skewed view on the world that he slowly over time corrupts the entire crew. And there has to be a breaking point. There has to be a breaking point, and we get there. And I love that as a concept of like this war-torn captain who's really good at the morally fucked up shit that's required of the times.
Yes.
But what's the cost of that for everyone around him? Because he has no cost. He loves it. This is where he thrives.
I figured out what my note should have been. Such a delight.
Oh, he took his shirt off, so it was a delight. Jason Isaacs taking his shirt off. Phaser in his pants. Wish that was me in them.
You were interested in his sausage more than the AI sausage that came along.
Now, with Lorca, he was the ongoing foe that they had, and yet they didn't know it. There was several points throughout the season in which
an antagonist for a long time before he was a villain.
That's it, because throughout the season, people would argue against him. There would be Stamets, it would be Colbert, it would be Saru, it would be Michael. Everyone would have a difference of opinion, and mm-hmm. sometimes they would win out, but more often, and
they
this is what I loved about Lorca, more often he would actually win.
Yeah.
Because the writing and the performance gave him so many layers.
Yeah, he knew how to play the game of politics. Because he was so used to playing it the dirty way that the Terrans do compared to Prime Universe. So it makes a lot of sense.
Do you have a favourite Lorca moment? Do you have something that, when you think back on this character who we still have an affinity for after all of this time, is there something?
Sadly, it's like the dumb lines. Like, he's the one that says context is for kings.
And, it is.
And I don't have time for the metaphysics.
We have absolutely no time to talk about the metaphysical implications. Yeah, he says that. Great line.
That is great. Also, his Scooby-Doo moment of, I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you meddling Starfleet people.
I really like the episode where he had to contend with somebody who actually knew him.
Yeah.
Which was with the Admiral. Mm-hmm. And he charmed her, he swooed her, but there was too many inconsistencies mm-hmm. for her to not notice.
Yeah.
And then he manages to wiggle his way out of that and lure her into a Klingon trap.
Mm-hmm.
That was, and you didn't know in that moment, they really did play it well. You didn't know if he did that like on purpose or if mm-hmm. that was just how it played out. Because again, the Klingons throughout this season would just ambush and attack and come out of nowhere. And they would do that. Like when they captured Lorca, it was just like they got Lorca. And I actually really did like, as much problems as I have with Ash Tyler, I liked Lorca and Ash Tyler's relationship.
Yeah.
I thought they brought out really interesting things in one another.
They did.
And you get to see these two British actors put on American accents and play with one another in the scenes. And
their
relationship
helped flesh both of them out.
It gave Lorca reasonable deniability of for someone like myself, I'm like, obviously he's evil. But then mm-hmm. you see him have conversations and mm-hmm. honestly bond with Ash Tyler over what it is like to suffer, over what it is like to be someone going through PTSD and guilt and all of that. And I still want to ask you this. Do you think his, because he never finds out Ash Tyler was Vok, he never finds out he was a Klingon. When you think back, even with the reveal of what Lorca was, do you believe that he was just playing Ash Tyler? Or do you think that was a moment, a window into him opening up? Because he does open up to people.
Yeah.
We know this. Like, Lorca, the bad guy, he does.
I think it is a window because we see that that is part of his history of and part of his weakness as a Terran is that he wants connection.
But he can't help but be in control.
Yeah.
Because this was the thing, and I unlike with Laurel, where the sloppiness or just ickiness of playing her as a sexual predator, Lorca, on the other hand, he's a groomer. That's his whole entire thing. He brings Michael on board and he does all of this stuff and he believes that fate and destiny is on their side because he's horny for her.
Yeah.
And when I say it like that, it sounds crude and rude and dumb, but I think the show played it very well. Like, I thought with Lorca's writing in particular as like an ongoing presence that challenged Starfleet, that challenged mm-hmm. the Federation, that challenged the crew of Discovery, he was very, very effective because at the time, and even now, there are people who sit and ponder, did any of his stuff have value? Because most often, when a villain like this is dispensed with, people will clap their hands and went, none of it had value because they were just a bad guy. But I think Lorca oversteps that at times more so.
Yeah, because he blurs the line at certain points where there's enough for you to dig into and discuss and debate over what were his motivations and how much did he know, how much was he doing consciously.
And he's an idiot. He's an idiot. End, the reveal is he's just one of those bigots that can't process things. He can be this tactician, this insidious figure who can fool an entire different universe into believing that he is this man. Mm-hmm. But then when he has to drop that, he's so pig-headed that he can't see the forest for the trees. I like the moment so much.
Because he thinks that it's inevitable that he will win.
Mm-hmm, because he's smarter than everyone else and he deserves it. Fate has bestowed it upon him. But I was going to say, I love the moment where Michael says, if you told us, we would have helped you to get back home. And he has, Jason Isaacs plays it, again, great actor to get for this. He just has this dawning realization, oh, it was that simple. I didn't need to do this Machiavellian plan. It was all for nothing because I can't fathom the idea that you can just ask for help or that you can just rely on others. That you can't, it's a Terran way of you have to backstab and make ploys and manipulate your way to the top. And great commentary. Now, we'll go off of Lorca with this. Do you feel him being a mirror universe mirror universe figure pretending to be the Prime was a good move in the end or not?
Yeah, I think it worked overall.
I feel conflicted. I feel like when he does switch over, he becomes boring.
Would it have been more interesting if he was a Prime universe person? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I love the idea of it. I love that concept of because it was always bullshit that the idea that the mirror universe
works for me.
Yeah, I always thought it was bullshit that the mirror universe people couldn't blend into ours.
Yeah.
When their entire thing is that they're duplicitous. So why couldn't they? In fact, wouldn't they be really good at it?
Wouldn't they be better at it than us?
And that's the line they use for why Lorca can't survive in their universe. None of our people could survive there, which is... come on, no one buys that for a second. We're all waiting for Prime Lorca to come back. But that's season one. Jeez Louise, I'm getting hot and bothered. And George Al's technically a villainous figure, but, the mirror George Al, but she's kind of a friend in a way. She has her moments. But season two, they strip it back, and they have two primary foes, two primary baddies.
Two, when they work in tandem.
Yes, one can't exist without the other. Mm-hmm. So who is our first big one that we're going to talk about here?
Leland. The head of...
Oh, he was Section 31.
Yeah. He was in charge of Section 31. That was his job. Because they can't leave that idea alone.
Oh, people love Section 31. I've never had a big...
Ryan, if everybody loves it so much, why haven't they made the Section 31 show?
Movie. They're making it into a TV movie and they're filming it right now with Oscar-winning actress Michelle Yeoh. They're filming it.
I know that, but they were planning to do a spin-off back then.
Well, Rachel, the Starfleet Academy show... is still getting made, so it's fine. This is Star Trek. This is Star Trek. Things take off. But note down what Rachel did, everyone. Leland, and we immediately want to talk about anything else. No offense to the performer. He does a solid job, but Leland as a character...
It's just... Okay.
Say what you want about Cole. He had a fucking ethos.
I'm going to give you my... Do you want my original note or my revised note first?
Give us one, then the other. The original, then the revised. Then we can see the journey.
I had such a wanker.
Yeah.
Down, and now I'm like, such a pancake.
No.
He's just flat. And, you get stuff on top of him and it makes it kind of more interesting. But, had potential... But now I'm like, pancake is too good because I like pancakes.
The biggest issue that Section 31 has ever had, the concept, the characters, all of it. After DS9, we get some little teasing in Enterprise, and it's big in the extended universe and games and so on. And then Discovery brings it back full force, and you have Leland. The biggest problem with it is William Sadler, who was the in DS9, he's too good.
Yeah.
He's too good. Personally, I do not like Section 31 as a concept in Star Trek. I don't like it. But in spite of all of that, his performance, William Sadler's performance, is so damn good as Sloan that I can't help but be invested. And then everything else is a weakness in comparison, because here's my major issue with Leland that makes him difficult to pin down in a way of anything. The writing and the performance play him as someone doing their job. He comes across as a manager, but what does he believe? Does he genuinely believe this? Is he someone at any point that you felt you couldn't trust? Not really. I never felt like he was someone I couldn't trust, like Sloan, where Sloan's like, dude, making a pact with him will fuck you in the end. Leland, I honestly think that he'll genuinely helpful.
Yeah. He'll do his best.
It's like, but the show would constantly tell you, Leland, he's not a great guy, but the performance, especially when
he's bald, don't trust him.
Don't trust him, he's bald. But remember his big thing, which was his connection to Michael. Do you remember?
He could have saved.
Kind of.
He could have sent somebody.
He had information that leaked out that then cost the lives of her parents.
Yeah.
But the weirdest thing is he seems genuinely remorseful.
Yeah. And it's like, it's that weird thing of the show is telling us that he's a villain. And everything that's happening in the show is just making him a very mild antagonist.
He just seems like a person who will help them.
Yeah.
But then when he's with Georgiou and Ash Tyler, he seems like a supremely competent manager at a store. Like, at a store. He doesn't feel like a military figure. He doesn't feel like a black ops guy. He doesn't feel someone who's in the politics.
He doesn't. But I do... Okay, well, I'm going to ask you a question to help us transition, which is, do you prefer Leland as an antagonist or control?
I prefer neither of them.
But those are our both for... are the two for season two.
Leland's a character, so that's a big step up.
Yeah.
So it has to be Leland. But again, here's something that befuddles me. This is another choice. And I would love to know from people watching if they feel similar or different. He's Section 31. Their whole thing is no one knows who they are.
Everybody fucking knows.
They wear badges tell you who they are. But here's something that befuddles, like truly befuddles me. Pike knows who Leland is. They have a history. They knew each other from like back in the day. I think that ruins Leland entirely, because at every turn, Pike has the benefit of the doubt that Leland will do the right thing because he knows him, which is different to what I want from Section 31, where Sloan, even if Bashir got to know him through many different adventures, he still couldn't trust the dude because he didn't actually know him, because you couldn't know him because that's their fucking job. Like, that's their job. And then control. I don't know.
Aye, sausage.
Control is control the worst? Is control the worst baddie in the show? Is control the worst big bad thing that they have to go up against?
It's definitely down there, but like, control succeeds in fucking things up for our protagonists more than some of the other villains do.
But you don't even know that for a long time in the show, I guess.
No,
I don't know.
That's why it's a very strange situation with control, because we have this evil entity technology.
This evil AI that's reminiscent to the Borg in a lot of ways.
Decimate the universe and
destroy all life.
Destroy all life. And somehow we've got seasons after this where we're meant to buy that it's an even bigger threat than destroying all life.
It's hard to go up from here, but it's a non-character, like it's a non-corporeal villain that inhabits a meat suit have a face, to have a voice, to have a personality. But my thing with Control that I find to be...
wouldn't get a sentient ship without it.
That's the Sphere Data, so we get that. But what I was going to say with Control is, other than I don't find the whole the galaxy will be destroyed as a ticking time bomb threat that interesting.
Well, they
personally
won't let that happen.
That won't happen, obviously. It's a non-character. It's just it's this entity that we have to take care of. And because of the mystery of the season of the red signals, the way that the information is doled out for Control is very confusing. And it would constantly say, it's not sentient, and yet Control would say and act like something that's sentient and has feelings and has wants, needs, desires, and has a personality, and yet it itself and other characters. I don't know. Like, Control is just one of those things in which it's something that filled up the time and made what you said happen, which is it was a thing that made the characters go through struggles, but what do you say about it? Like, with Lorca, with Cole, with Takuvma, with Laurel, like, even with Leland. In theory with Leland more than an execution, there's something that you can say about what it does to challenge the characters. What does it say, Control, about what's the ideological difference it brings up? What's its themes that it brings out in the show other than, well, AI goes crazy sometimes.
Yeah. Technology is dangerous.
The worst Black Mirror episodes are the ones in which it feels like, oh no, they're telling us cell phones are bad. And that's how I feel about Control. Cell phones are bad.
Yeah.
But it did control Leland. And this was another truly bizarre thing. Every character, when Leland was controlled by Control, were like so like thrilled to kill this guy. And they kept talking about Leland was like this really awful. But like Leland did nothing. Nothing. So it was very weird when everyone was like, I can't wait to fucking kill Leland in any way. And it's like, what did he do?
Including Nan.
Yeah, Nan. What's her problem? But she's very hungry. So she licked her lips and said, yum, yum, at the idea of making him scream. And season two, they kept it to two. They stripped it back. And what do you think about just the landscape of the villains there, where in a way it's more simple? So that way you would say it should be better, where because in season one your notes were had potential, could have been more, could have been this.
Yeah.
Season two, can you say the same?
Yes. Yeah. But that was an ongoing issue that we had with Discovery, was the ideas weren't the problem. Each season they had ideas that were interesting and could have been good. But what we got served was not what we wanted.
What they learned the wrong lesson from season one with the villains, which is we should have less of them, is the thing. So what I mean by that is they thought
we wanted them to be more fleshed out.
We wanted more time spent and we wanted more definition. Mm. Look, less of them physically speaking, like less numerically, but in terms of them in the show, Lorca was a great example of how it worked, of like you had him ongoing, in which I could keep going for an hour about Lorca, but with Leland, with Control, it's hard to muster up 5 seconds. And that's where we go to season three. They launch into the future because of Control. Control, the danger of them makes it so that the Discovery no longer is in the comfy era that we know. They go to the wild, wild west, and that's where we bring in our new right-hand man of the big bad of season three, Zaheer. Is that their name? Zaheer? I don't remember his name, but I remember him. He's the cowboy.
Yeah, and I remember being like, I'm having fun with you. But I remember nothing else.
Is that your note? You remember nothing? Wow.
Like, actually, I didn't write a note because I left him because I was just like, I need to look him up on the wiki to remember anything. So I guess it's such a nothing.
I loved him.
But he was delightful. I remember that. Like, I remember the feelings, but I was like, yeah, like, so he must be with Osyra.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, I can't remember a thing that he did.
He was in our favourite episode, Far From Home, the saloon that Saru and Tilly and eventually Georgiou go to. And he's the main figure there where he's holding it up and he is being evil. And Jake Webber, the actor, I know him from a bunch of things and he's great here. He has this Devil May Care energy and he feels like a Star Trek villain, like maybe a villain of the week, but he feels like one of those, like an Enterprise era or Voyager era bad guy, in which we talked about with Kenneth Mitchell, he's having fun. That's something I love about villains in movies and shows and antagonists, is they are having fun because they are unrestricted. They are no longer brought down to the ground because of a moral compass. And this person here is playing evil cowboy. He has spurs, Rachel.
Yeah! Yeah, he does!
He loves shooting people with his slow burn phasers and
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, again, another villain that delights in murder.
Delights in murder, and here's why we had to bring him up. Because some people may say, why bring him up? I mean, he does get kicked off of a turbo lift because he slammed a Grudge. But here's why. Osyra, get rid of her. Have this guy. If this guy was revealed to be the top dog of the Emerald Chain, yeah, you can make him an Orion, I don't care. But this actor and this character, I found to be much more entertaining and thought-provoking.
Oh, you want to kick the girl boss out?
Thank you. Yes, I want to kick the first, big girl boss villain outside of Laurel, who became a good guy. Oh, good girl. But I mean it.
You've said that before. Like that, I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That reminds me of things that we've discussed in the past. I just don't care about the Emerald Chain.
I love them as an idea, but I don't think we got a good definition of what they were. Like, in one of the last episodes, they mentioned that they have, a parliament.
Again,
and I'm like, what?
It's another thing where it's just, it's just the one season and they defeat this network of villains.
Like their own federation.
Are represented by these two particular people. And it's just okay, I care even less now that at the end of it, because it was never something that was going to last for more than a season with Discovery.
Don't know why.
Because they change the show every season, if not every
half a season. Mm-hmm.
So it was just this is an idea that's interesting, but it's not going to get developed. So I didn't get attached to it, and I didn't get attached to him, especially because he was way more direct and reminiscent of Lorca.
Mm-hmm.
In lots of ways. So it's just
a Southern accent swagger, yeah.
It's just you're gonna fuck up or be fucked over. And that's just, okay, we're in episode 3, my guess is.
Well, he barely appears. He appears in episode 2 and then he's gone for half the season, and then he comes back with a hand injury because of the parasitic ice. But why I bring it up is Osyra, the head of the Emerald Chain, the big, nasty lady who you hear so much about her. You hear about her.
Fake out with her in that first episode that she's in is just...
Fake out? In what way? Now you're making me have to remember, because Osyra, she's the one in which I am like you, where I go,
No, didn't she... pretend to be somebody to get on Discovery to take over the ship?
No, you're thinking of Strange New Worlds, I'm pretty sure. A better character. The pirate character who was better. Yeah. Yeah, you thought of them. A great example of a similar concept executed with much more of an effect. Osira is this slave driver, slave master, slaver, like evil, like Orion, mm-hmm. and she's a capitalist and greedy, and she's so sniveling that she's going to use any tactic to keep herself alive. That's what she's about.
Is she there for the eat shit?
Yeah, she was there to taste pretty good for shit. Mm-hmm. And she, her, well, get it out of the way. I don't think the performance is very good, and I think it's hampered by the Orion makeup, where it's so heavy that it mm-hmm. locks their facial expressions in, so it's more difficult to mm-hmm. give the actor leeway of how good they
it's
are.
It's like she can't lift her face, like the muscles.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
and it's not a character...
She can't move them enough.
Yeah, and the forehead. She's not a character that you can say, oh, well, the fact that they're so apathetic adds to their scariness. So there's that. And then she does things that should be good, but the show waits too long. Like, for instance, steal Stamets. So that way you can control the
Very
ship.
Very logical.
It takes like near the end of the show for that to happen.
Yeah.
So when it does happen, you're looking at your watch, as you say, and you go, well, there's not much you can play with Mm-mm. this. And that's my thing with Osira, where I could list you, and we did on our podcast, various ways to have improved that character. Because on paper, I think that they offered up a whole wealth of material, but...
It's not a problem with the ideas, it's a problem with the execution.
It's one in which, let it breathe. Let this live out. Let this be ongoing, and I don't need...
Make a character?
And I don't even mean make it ongoing into another season. No. Introduce her earlier in the season and have her be a foil to go mm-hmm. with, because what I like about her is she challenges the Federation as it exists in the future. They want to hold on to their ideals, mm-hmm. and yet... their methodology and their attitudes in a way led to
outdated.
The destruction of were outdated and were not fair. And mm-hmm. she was saying, here's how the real world works. When you lost all of your dilithium, we picked up the pieces, and we picked up the pieces the way we knew how, which is with force.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that be a recurring thing for mm-hmm. a lot of the antagonists in Discovery, which is their sick, twisted resentment for the Federation and wanting to install their own version of it, which in the end is only to benefit the one in charge of it rather than the whole, because that's what Osira is about. She doesn't actually care about making the galaxy better or sharing resources. All she cares about is her own skin. That's why... you have this, like, again, this was an intriguing move. She goes to Starfleet and she wants to sign a deal. She wants to make peace. She wants to merge the Emerald Chain with the remaining of the Starfleet and Federation. And she has paperwork. She's here. She's physically sitting there. That was an interesting wrinkle. Like, and if you had a season of her, that would have paid off really well as, like, this growth. And then the reveal, she's so... slippery that she would rather tear it up and shoot people than hand herself in. Now, can I ask you something that we haven't talked about very much, which is dispensing with antagonists? Is it a issue with you now with Discovery that 99% of the antagonists are just murdered by our heroes, mm-hmm. and none of them get to be apprehended, learn, grow, change, be challenged themselves? They serve as a challenge to the heroes, but the mm-hmm. heroes never get to challenge them, because in the end, the heroes or people involved will kill them.
Yeah, they either become good or they die.
Well, who becomes good? Just Laurel, right?
Yeah.
The rest of them get killed. Lorca gets killed, Tukuma gets killed.
It's blurry with Vok.
Vok is dead.
Vok
Ash Tyler
is dead,
is alive.
But Vok is present within Ash Tyler, and Ash Tyler is a good guy.
I guess. But I bring this up because Osira It really just so, I don't know how, it, like, she was a shitty person, but just, Michael just executes her. She shoots her in the head.
To clearly end it, because it's just like, by the time that you get to the end of the villain's stories in Discovery, they've done it. They're done it with it. They want to move on. So killing them, it's like, well, they're not going to come back. We're done now. They're no longer a threat permanently.
And not entirely, but a good helping of the time, what they did only ripples for a short while, because we've got to move on. Because
the emerald chain is gone.
But this is what I liked about season four.
Mm-hmm.
Although the emerald chain being dissolved really quickly is lazy, in my opinion, and Osyra herself as a character wasn't particularly of interest to us, season four gave us an antagonist that I think is Discovery's best, the most fleshed out, the one that has...
The one that you have been eagerly waiting to get to, because this is the villain that we were the most satisfied with.
This is someone who was affected by the past of the show, the Emerald Chain. He's someone that is directly tied to characters that we care about.
It mattered that he was who he was and at that time and with those people. Like, everything around him made a difference.
And who's this man?
Taka.
Ruan Taka. Wow. Now, we are Taka fans, which is not a popular position.
No.
People who don't like Discovery and people who do like Discovery often agree on this one thing, that Taka was not a good character or not a good villain or was boring, like nothing, was too much of a prick to care about. When we were doing this, when we were getting ready for this podcast festival, a little behind the scenes, met up with all of the other podcasts to chat and get to know each other and find out what we're doing. And when I mentioned that I really want to talk about Taka, he was a character I liked, no joke, and these are from podcasts who people will check out on this festival, I got replies of, oh, he was boring. Well, that guy sucks. Why would you want to talk about him? And I'm like, these are from people who like Discovery way more than we do. And I'm like, here's the thing. Taka is what I needed from a Discovery villain. They have an ongoing relationship that evolves and changes throughout the season. He, at the start, is supposed to be a counterpart to Stamets. He's taking Stamets' research. He's the top dog, and he's got that arrogance that Stamets had at the beginning.
Part of what I really liked about Taka is that he was a threat to their progress, not just to their lives. It wasn't, he wasn't out to kill them, which made him different from all of the other villains, pretty much. All of the other villains were like, do what I want or I'll kill you. And Taka wants to get what he wants, but he doesn't want to have to kill for it.
But he will. And that's what you see him come to terms with. He is willing to do that. But Taka. People don't like this guy because he's too much of a prick, too much of a jerk. And I think that's perfect because guess what? I want to have feelings about the antagonists or characters in general. And that's not a lazy thing to say because they make him so much of an arrogant son of a bitch that you instinctively hate him.
Yeah.
But I couldn't help but notice, and
you're
like,
oh, somebody punch him in the face, please.
But here's the thing, and they do it deliberately. He is so much like Stamets when we met Stamets.
Yeah.
He's copying Stamets' work. He's copying his kind of character, but he's dialed up a few extra notches, and you wonder why, other than he's bad guy. And the thing that I love so much about season four is they spend episodes and scenes on Taka's interiority.
Just him.
On his interiority.
Just him. We get flashbacks for him.
We get conversations about why he feels the way he does and how he even understands that it's probably not for the best, but feelings are feelings.
He's
it's hard to go over them.
To the path. He's committed to the plan. And because he's lost everything else, he doubles down.
I like an antagonist, not just one like Lorca, who gets to spend their time with the crew and sway them in ways that turn them bad. But I like ones like Taka, in which they are a warning of what could be.
Mm.
Because Taka is very much like Michael in many moments. He's very much like Book, hence he teams up mm-hmm. with Book. He's very much like Stamets. And what I like about it is, you have seen throughout Discovery, our heroes, our crew, do some of the most ludicrous...
Heinous!
Not just heinous, but like ambitious, ludicrous, mm-hmm. universe-tearing stuff to save the ones they love.
Mm-hmm.
Think back to Stamets and Culber.
Yeah. Yeah.
They tear apart this thing to get Culber out of the mycelial network. Absolutely ludicrous stuff. But we sympathize with it because they're doing it for love, they're doing it for emotion, and we have mm-hmm. followed their journey of grief and suffering. Taka, on the other mm-hmm. hand, he's alone. And we see what happens with someone like him, in which he has the capabilities, mentally speaking, and then eventually physically speaking mm-hmm. with the tech, to do the stuff that Discovery has done in the past in terms of like this, like universe-shattering technological jumps to save people. You see what someone like that does, but they're alone. They don't have support. They don't have backup. They don't have anyone to help them emotionally mature. They have mm-hmm. just suffered and suffered and suffered. So they don't have like anything to ground them.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask you this about Lorca.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think his relationship with Ash was sincere mm-hmm. in any way? Taka and Book. Do you think that Taka was just using Book, was just fueling Book, was maybe just manipulating him to feel the way that he does? Or do you think there was anything true to it at any point? Anything emotionally
true?
Yeah,
I do think there ended up being an element of truth there. But I think that was Taka despite himself.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want it, but he fell into it. And it almost derails him. It almost stops him. But it's not quite enough.
I think he did at points.
Mm-hmm.
But
So we're very similar.
I do think he did at points, but mm-hmm. I don't think he recognized what connection was.
No.
He had completely lost what mm-mm. true connection yeah. was because he lost the one person he think he had
it
with.
He didn't see it as the lifeline that it was.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And he exploited it for his own means.
Yes.
And again, why I feel like Taka is Discovery's best antagonist, best foe is... At first, you love to hate him, and many people still hate him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was moved by him because the more time we spent, the more complicated my feelings became about him. There was little streaks, like little brushstrokes added to his character, like him being from Ryza, and yet he's the most mm-hmm. brilliant scientist, and he doesn't have to give a shit about social cues because he's that important, and yet we've mm-hmm. seen characters that we know and love be the exact same way, and yet it's good when Sarek does it because, hey, yeah. he's a Vulcan, and he's the mm-hmm. best of the best speakers, so he can just be an asshole, but mm-hmm. hey, it's fine because he's good in the end. While Taka, he believes he's doing mm-hmm. good for him. He is driven by himself. And again, it's a warning of what could happen to the Discovery crew. Reno actually has a great conversation about it, in which mm-hmm. he's fallen too far into the suffering, into the grief.
Yeah.
And we haven't mentioned it, but Sean Doyle, mm-hmm. the performer,
mm-hmm.
he's great.
Yeah.
And we watched this before having seen The Expanse.
Yeah, we did. It made us more excited to see him in The Expanse.
With this character and this performer, what about him for you in any more detail would you like to get into about how come he rises to the top for us with Discovery in terms of the foes, the antagonists, the bad guys?
Well, I think the point that I want to make clear, I think we've already kind of established this, but he is such a character. He is a whole character. He has flaws. He has benefits. He has interactions. He has defined relationships with a lot of the cast. And that makes him so much more interesting.
It does. And I guess one of my big final pieces on Tarka, because we could be here for a very long time, just to talk about what I love about him even more, is he's charming whilst also being insufferable.
Yeah!
And he is a great benefit of what the show gets accused of, even by us at times, which is it's too emotional. You often hear that be the siren call from us even, and people who loathe this show, that the series would lean too heavy on, oh, my emotions, I'm so sad, and now I'm all of this. I cry all the time, I'm angry. And I think Tarka was a great example of using that and actually exploring it, because he comes across as this typical Star Trek villain where he has a grudge, he's a smart aleck, he's a super genius with a super weapon who's going to kill everyone.
Tick, 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 tick.
But we see that he is a victim of what Discovery gets accused of, which is over-emotionality. Mm-hmm. We see that his overwhelming sense of grief and guilt and loss has consumed him to the point of doing something so irredeemably bad because he is so lost.
Yeah, I really do think you hit the nail on the head with the phrasing of consumed by.
Because although I get annoyed at how much Discovery can be a little bit melodramatic, with Tarka, it's very subdued. It's very subdued. Like when we have those flashbacks and his relationship forming in when he was a prisoner, it's not overwrought. And when he's on the planet and he's having conversations with Book, Sean Doyle plays it very, very, very low. And I thought that was authentic. And then he ends the way he lived in a Schrodinger's cat, in a fashion where he wanted to go into this universe thinking that his friend went there, but he doesn't know that for a fact. And if he opened that box, would the cat be alive or dead?
Yep.
And
so he won't look.
And so he won't look. And yet the entire journey is him wanting to open that box, and yet he doesn't. It's a thing of he does all of this stuff, even though he knows in his brain this person could be dead, and yet he doesn't want that to be true. And yet if they were alive, what would they think of what he's done? And he can't open that Schrodinger's like that box with Schrodinger's cat in there. And that's what his fate is. We don't know if Tarka made it or not. Do you think he made it, or do you think he died? Do you think he got exploded or vaporized, or do you think he succeeded?
I don't know.
Nor do I. I think that is the benefit of it more so.
The fact that we care enough to ask the question, and we're interested enough that we want to keep it open.
And we mentioned that they often kill their antagonists, and it can be a bit of a downside for us. This is one in which it's because he got hoisted by his own petard. He brought that upon himself. This is the culmination of all of his beliefs and his actions, and now he gets to exist in our minds as this mystery thing. You, watching this and listening, can say, oh, Tarka died.
Yeah.
Or you can say Tarka did this, but the thing is, we don't know. Just like how he didn't know.
It doesn't give the answer. And in a show like Discovery, where you get an answer for every single little thing, it's really refreshing.
And Tarka, for some reason, in a season that's very much beloved by Star Trek Discovery fans, it wasn't our favorite, but many fans love season four, and yet I have seen and interacted with the hatred of this character.
Mm-hmm.
We were there at the time when the episodes were airing and we were watching podcasts like Strange New Pod talk about this character with derision and mm-hmm. disdain and just boredom and just get on with it. I don't care about this guy. He's a jerk. He's an asshole. What do you think it is that we are missing here? What do you think it is that can cause such a reaction for people who are much more in the trenches of Star Trek Discovery than you and I?
I think a part of it is we enjoy a jerk.
Mm.
Like, we like characters that are bad people. That doesn't, for us, a bad person can make a good character. And we found Harker to be a good character in a show that we weren't liking, and we found a lot of other characters lacking.
I have to agree in some way with that, because there's a lot of conversation about how he's just a bad guy. He's mm-hmm. just overwhelmingly shitty. Like, his attitude mm-hmm. is shitty. So yeah. I can't tolerate him. Again, I understand that, because at times you can roll your eyes and go, oh yeah, this guy's just a dickhead. But another thing that I think is a downside, and it is a downside, is why there's boredom with Taker is he's so familiar, yes. yet in spite of what we love about him being unique for this series, which is he is megalomaniac with a super weapon who's going to destroy the galaxy. It's any Star Trek villain. He can't escape it. He can't escape that curse. So
especially
when we were watching
movie
it.
Especially movie.
So even with all of the stuff we said in praise of him, he's wrapped up in that.
Oh, yeah. Like, he's too familiar. Yeah, he gets bogged down with that. Like, I don't begrudge anybody who doesn't like Taka.
No. And we talk about it on our podcast, which is, do they need to stop with villains in this show? The fifth season will have some. We've seen some press photos of them. But when season four came around and it was pitched as there's going to be no villain per se, but a non-corporeal threat, everyone was thrilled with that, because we're tired of these villains that come and go and just fill the same role in a lot of ways. And then when Taka came along, it felt like to me at the time, a slap in the face of like, oh, we're really doing this still. Because
you got to do something like that, because it has a purpose within the script and we still need that purpose to be fulfilled.
And with any show, they follow their formulas, whether mm-hmm. it's Buffy or Dexter or Star yeah. Trek Discovery, where mm-hmm. each season,
rinse, repeat.
Like you said, the show changes itself in this way. It will dispense with storylines or characters because they're over with, and mm-hmm. reliance on seasoned villains that maybe they aren't as fleshed out as they could be. But that's where we wrap this up of the Discovery villains, the Discovery antagonists. Mm-hmm. What do you get out of it all? Now that we have watched the show and we've talked about them, what mm-hmm. is your big takeaway about Discovery's antagonists and how they were implemented, handled, and how you feel about them at the end of it all?
They are all convenient. And they serve their purpose and then they're dispensed with.
I look at Discovery's antagonists as individuals that put on the guise of something else, of like...
Yes, there's a duplicity.
There's always a duplicity in there.
In all of them.
And yet they have an inherently selfish reason to yeah. try and deconstruct mm-hmm. the Federation or the status quo mm-hmm. that we know. And weirdly enough, the show I would relate this to the most with its antagonists mm-hmm. is Legend of Korra. Each season would have their antagonist yeah. and would have an ideological mm-hmm. thing that would be a commentary, and yet it would be defused at the end of the season and wagged the finger of clearly they're wrong and nothing they said or did should be taken into consideration because they were bad and now they're dead. They did a different thing where one villain got to live and see the ramifications of their actions, which was great. And I think that's Discovery, where the villains are all self-motivated, and yet they will put on, most of them, the allure of being for something greater than themselves.
Yeah, they all have an ideology that they present in one way or another, and how authentic that is differs from villain to villain.
And we see each season how it strengthens the Discovery's resolve in believing in a group, in an institution, in an establishment, in Starfleet, in the crew, and in eventually Michael herself. And I think that is like a great thing for the Discovery villains. I do wish, though, that more of them got to be fully rounded characters. It isn't like we get a Golda cut in this show. It's not like we even get like, you know, a Harry Mudd even, where, you know, where Harry Mudd's a Harry Mudd of this show, but you know what I'm talking about, where you get these recurring baddies. Or what you even said about like that one pirate from Strange New Worlds, you remembered them. You're like, oh, even though they haven't been back since as we record this, you go, oh, that's a thing, but...
At this point, I do want to mention what my original pitch was for this episode.
Of course.
Because you told me that we were going to be discussing the villains. And I was like, Michael, right? Michael's the villain of the show, right?
No, the real villain.
I was like, can we talk about how she fucks everything up?
But it works out in the end.
It works out.
The real villain. And this is the truth.
Sparks?
Incorrect.
The CGI sparks are everywhere.
The real villain is Nilsson's wig. That fucking wig they put on her.
Fucking terrible wig.
That
so
fucking
terrible.
Wig is actually the most evil entity in all of Star Trek. It's sweaty. It's filthy. Heck, it makes Crusher's wigs in TNG look great.
Yeah.
They look fucking great. I'm missing
leagues above.
I'm missing the Deanna Troi wigs at this point.
That's the end of our discussion on Discovery's villains. All 10 of them that we picked out. There were more that you could argue.
Cole's family
could be on this list. What else?
Discovery is ending. It's coming to a close. We will be watching it. We will be covering it in a rewatch format. That's how we do our podcast. We like to rewatch Discovery because we want to look at the puzzle pieces as they are all done and get an understanding of if they were put together right or wrong from our point of view. You can find us at Yum Yum Podcast on any of those social medias or podcasting sites, including YouTube.
They should be all linked in the description for you, including a link to our Patreon.
Oh, yes, of course. And we have to thank Strange New Pod for making this podcast festival and letting us join in the fun. Because we're the real antagonists of the Star Trek Discovery podcast, because we're not as hot to trot with it as many of the others are. And yet,
especially
we don't think Tark is boring.
It.
Yes, but we will be back to cover it. But thank you for watching and joining us and listening to us. I can't wait to read the opinions and hear people's thoughts on the antagonists, what people's favorites are or least favorites, or are we wrong about Taka, or are we right about Osira, or is Leland more than we gave him credit for? So thank you all so much, and can't wait to see what the new baddies of Discovery have going on. I hear that they stole David Cronenberg's ancient alien Rubik's Cube. And that's... just can't tolerate that.